Good afternoon, everybody. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 11th. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building, the Bitch Room. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Kaufman, Senator Giesel, and Senator Dunbar. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and myself, Senator Wilson. This afternoon, we have four items on the agenda. First, we'll do a confirmation hearing for Dr. David Barnes from the State Medical Board. Then we'll take up SB 106, Home and Community-Based Waiver Services by Senator Giesel. Then Senate Bill 24, Public Schools Mental Health by Senator Gray Jackson, who's also here in the room. And we will take up Senate Bill 91, Telehealth Multidisciplinary Disciplinary Teams by Senator Klayman. At this time, we have... We'll invite Dr. David Barnes to speak upon his qualifications, credentials, and his reasons for wanting to be confirmed to the State Medical Board. Dr. Barnes, are you with us this afternoon?
Hi.
Hi. If you could place yourself on the record and just tell us a little bit about yourself and, again, the reasons of wanting to serve on the State Medical Board.
Certainly. I appreciate that. I'm David L. Barnes, Wasilla, Alaska, Internal Medicine, and I understand I'm being recorded and on the record. I was born and raised in southern Minnesota, Mankato specifically. I typically grew up with two brothers doing work around the house and then also on my grandparents' farms in northern Iowa. It was a rural environment, basically. I got a pilot's license at age 17 and then went on to get a commercial pilot's license with an instrument rating and eventually became a certified flight instructor. I graduated from Gustavus Adolphus College in 1985, another college in southern Minnesota, with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Russian Studies and pre-med focus. I, interestingly enough, did not go right to medical school. I instead worked for the National Security Agency, NSA, for 9 years from 1986 to 1995. I worked at headquarters in the Washington, D.C. area and then a covert site after that. For 5.5 years. While in Washington, I did the first year of a master's degree program at Georgetown University in National Security Studies. I only got 1 year done because I then did a permanent change of station to the other facility. I started medical school in 1995 at the University of North Texas Health Science Center and graduated in 1999. I then did an internal medicine residency at St. Joseph Hospital in Denver, Colorado, which is the largest private hospital in the Denver area, from 1999 till 2002. I graduated from that program and worked as a hospitalist at the major hospitals in Denver. Hospitalists basically manage patients in hospitals, on the medicine wards and in the intensive care units. I got recruited by Valley Hospital and came to Alaska in June of 2003. I initially did a combined inpatient and outpatient practice where I worked in the hospital on call every 5 days, managing patients there from the emergency room and also in the clinics. Once we got a working hospitalist group up and running at Matsu Regional, I then switched 100% to outpatient care in clinics. I've been married since 1996 to my wife, Susan. She's a veterinarian, and we have 5 boys. She has said that boys and being married, we're mainly like dogs. We have a lot more animals, I think, at home than we do boys. My primary role, as I envision it, is to just participate in the regulation of the practice of medicine in Alaska per the statutes. I'm hoping that I can contribute also to professionalism of the medical industry up here and protect both the public and healthcare providers by reviewing cases. I think I'm good at doing this because I have provided care both inpatient in the major hospitals of Denver, also at Matsu Regional in the Alaska area, and then also outpatient care in both Denver and Wasilla. From a medical standpoint, I think Alaska is a unique environment when we compare ourselves to the rest of the world and the nation. We've got much of our population living in remote locations. I have a physician's assistant who works with me here in the office. She previously worked remotely in the federal healthcare system out in the villages, and she's talked to me about this in detail. She stated she commonly worked 1 or 2 weeks at a time in these different remote locations. The work was very demanding because many times she was the only provider available in a difficult situation. She didn't always have help in these situations and many times lacked for ideal health care. Often she had to transport patients to other locations for a higher level of care, Anchorage, Seattle, elsewhere. If weather was good, that typically wasn't a problem, but weather, as we know, isn't always guaranteed. Once the patient reached Anchorage or elsewhere, in medicine, we have to start an evaluation of a patient. So the patient reaches Anchorage, starts the evaluation. We find that the patient needs imaging studies, needs labs, needs surgical consultations. These things all take time. So suddenly, a visit that was supposed to be a quick trip in or had a defined end time all of a sudden has been extended. Now, the patient needs outpatient support. They need housing, they need clothing, they need food, they might need community support for wound care. When the patient has finally gone through their workup and they're able to leave, what if the weather's not good enough? What if we can't get the patient home? All of this can be quite complex, it can be distressing to patients, and it's certainly expensive, and this is very unique to Alaska. I also see Alaska having a deficit of healthcare providers. Recruiting providers to Alaska and retaining providers is very difficult. I think I'm qualified to help out based on my more than 20 years experience in both inpatient and outpatient healthcare in both urban and rural areas. I also think my aviation experience helps where you need to honestly do critical self-evaluation. You have to remain current with both technology and training. I hope you honestly find me suitable to serve on the board, and I look forward to working with the legislature and helping to provide oversight. One thing I guess I should mention also is, I neglected to mention this, I want to thank the legislature for one huge thing. House Bill 265 has helped out a lot with telehealth, and I look forward to maybe coming up with other things that will help out as well. Questions for me?
Thank you, Dr. Barnes. Are there questions for Dr. Barnes at this time? Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Barnes, for being willing to offer your time in this role. I may have missed it. When did you come to Alaska?
June of 2003.
Thank you. And a second question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please.
So one of the things, excuse me, one of the things that I ask board members, regardless of the board, is what the purpose of the board is. Could you tell me what your view of the purpose of the state medical board is?
Yes. My view of the board is basically to provide oversights, to help with conflict resolution, to see, as I understand it, we get complaints. We then use our experience and research of the statutes to see whether there is a basis for those complaints, and then decide whether there's been a violation and what needs to occur in terms of outcome based on that.
Senator Giesel?
Great. Thank you. That is a good summary of the mechanism. I would like to articulate that the purpose of a regulatory board for professional licenses is to protect the public through the regulation of that profession. So in this case, protection of the public through the regulation of safe practice of medicine. You certainly did identify when the public calls in with a complaint, it is the mission of the board to have their investigator investigate that complaint, bring the information back to the board, and then the board, with a recommendation, by the way, the investigator does recommend whether there's adequate evidence that a violation has taken place. But sometimes, especially professionals that are on a regulatory board, get, perhaps I'll use the word confused, thinking that they're there to protect the profession. You're actually there to protect the public. But you did a good job of explaining the mechanisms of it, that being the complaint, the oversight, and somewhat the conflict resolution, determining whether a violation actually took place and whether discipline needs to occur for that licensee. Thank you again, Dr. Barnes, for offering your name forward for this position. It is demanding, and I appreciate your willingness to serve. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Tobin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment as I'm looking at the authorizing statutes for the State Medical Board, and it says 5 licensed physicians residing in as many separate Alaska judicial districts as possible. We really want to ensure that we have representation from across the state for such an important and incredibly vital board that we have. And I'm looking at the current roster, and I notice that Mr. Barnes is from Palmer. We have another representative from Wasilla. We have 2 physicians from Anchorage and then 1 from Sitka. The individual from Sitka is the only one that's not on the road system. This gives me a little pause. And so I'm hopeful that as we continue on these confirmations, we can really look toward the need for representation on these different commissions and boards for our state, because there are those who, albeit have incredible background in aviation and other aspects, just don't know what it's like to live and work in rural Alaska. And having those voices in the room is very important. So I appreciate your name putting your name forward, Mr. Barnes, but I do have concern that we have quite a bit of representation from the Anchorage Matsu communities here on the board and not enough diverse representation from other parts of the state.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Are there any further comments or questions for Mr. Barnes? Mr. Barnes, I just have a question, but we can maybe answer this offline. It's not really to your qualifications for this board. Just find it interesting for your time having your Bachelor's of Arts Studies in Russian Studies and then your tenure at the NSA.
Yep.
Love to have a conversation with you about that one a future later date. But with that, is there a motion from committee? Senator Kaufman. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we taking public comment on
this? Oh, yes. You're correct. I apologize. Skipping the most important step. We'll now open up public testimony. Anyone here in the room in Juneau would like to testify for Dr. David Barnes? And seeing no one online, we will go ahead and close public testimony. Thank you for that oversight, Senator Diesel. Senator Kaufman.
I move the appointment of David Barnes to the State Medical Board, that it be forwarded to joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions.
All right. Seeing no objection, we will go ahead and take a brief at ease, and we'll call up our next item of business to the table, Senate Bill 106. Right, we are back on the record. Our next item of business is Senate Bill 106, Home and Community-Based Waiver Services, by Senator Giesel. At the table, we have Staff Senator Giesel, Paige Brown, and Senator Giesel is up here on the dais. We first heard this bill and took a sectional analysis and invited in public testimony on Tuesday, April 4th. Senator Giesel will update us on the status of the Department of the Application Waiver And we also have Lynn Kilman Cruz, the Department of Health and Senior Disability Services, on the phone for questions if any committee members choose to utilize that lifeline. And Senator Giesel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, during our hearing on April 4th, actually during the hearing, the federal government declined our request for an extension. So that makes the bill all the more important, as on May 11th, this waiver, which allows family members to be reimbursed for services caring for their Medicaid-eligible recipient, it will be eliminated. To be fair, however, as well, Mr. Chairman, as we all know, even though we may pass a bill, it is not immediately activated. There will be regulations that need to be written. So unfortunately, there will be a void, though the sooner we pass this, the sooner it will actually be implemented. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my aide, Paige Brown, can certainly fill in any other blanks. Thank you.
Is there any questions for Ms. Brown or Senator Giesel from committee members at this time? All right, seeing no amendments before us, do we have a motion or the will of the committee? Senator Kaufman.
I have a motion. I move Senate Bill 106, Home and Community-Based Waiver Services, version 33-LS0476-B, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 106, version B, has passed the committee. We'll take a brief at ease, and as we get ready for Senate Bill 24. We are back on the record. Before the committee is our third item of business is Senate Bill 24. We heard this bill, did a sexual analysis, and took invited public testimony on March 23rd. We have one amendment that is sponsored by myself, Senator Wilson, and I will make sure committee members have Amendment 1A. We'll take a brief at ease. We are back on the record. Sorry for that little delay. Just want to make sure everyone had the amendments before them. With that, I will move amendment A1.
I object for purposes of a discussion.
As this amendment adds a new section pertaining to parents' rights to education, the original parent notification is in statute under AS 1403016A. 3, and this adds the addition of mental health, as this was referenced in the statute in terms of parent notification. When we first heard this bill by the bill sponsor, that is what we're doing, and this just has that line here, and I'll read here from that statute. Providing a parent for parent notification no less than 2 weeks before an activity, class, or program that includes involvement of human reproduction or sexual matters, and this will now include the words or mental health as provided to a child. And with that, the other two items is just a resectioning, so reformatting to make sure the bill is still compliant with the new section being added to this piece of legislation. And that's the amendment. Questions? Comments? Everyone's looking to bill sponsor. Bill sponsor, have comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Dunbar.
I'm sorry, so are you saying this is just sort of clarifying this is already the case in other parts of statute, or are you adding this? And if so, sort of why?
My question. Yes, Senator Dunbar. So this is basically this new Section 2 is the actual piece of statute, and we are adding that line 14 or mental health to the piece of legislation as you know, previously when we had this piece of legislation before us, this was a more lengthier amendment, but as the bill sponsor says, parental notifications already happens under a piece of statute, and thought this might be a better way to clean this up is to add it in this piece of statute versus trying to come up with new language to add it. But the reason why is that there is a lot of issues that may happen. Kids may have other trauma or issues, and parents might need that notification to make sure if something did, that those additional supports might be ready for those children without the sort of a surprise coming home and having to deal with some other adverse effect or trauma or other transference issues or something else that might happen as while discussing mental health situations in the classroom. Yes.
So the parental notification in the other two sections, human reproduction and sexual matters, are pretty clearly defined, and they don't really touch on other, you know, aspects if you're teaching. And mental health is a little bit broader category, and I realize that other parts of the bill ask for specific instruction in mental health. So are you envisioning only sort of those specific courses that would come out of this would be required to have that notification, or would any lesson that touches on mental health in any topic be required to have a similar notification?
And I'm not sure if we have a definition of mental health currently in the bill. You're not. Yes, we'll take a. We do have a couple of folks online that might be able to help us here. We'll ask Ms. Sharon Fischel, Deeds Education for School Health, Safety, and Alternative Education, or Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for Innovation and Education Excellence. Do you have a definition in statute to define mental health?
Good afternoon. This is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for Division of Innovation and Education Excellence, and I would like to defer to Sharon Fischel. I believe she's on the line.
Ms. Fischel?
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Sharon Fischel with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I would have to get, you know, the definition of mental health can be very broad, and you can, you know, depending on what setting you're in and how it is, we could get back to you to answer that question. But I'm not prepared to answer that question right now.
Okay. Thank you. So, Senator Dunbar, we just left it broad, not trying to narrow down those specific topics, just like the same way that in the bill talks about some of those guidelines and health for having some of the DVSA components in here for the domestic violence, sexual assault. The same requirements are listed in here. That would also be listed, and just want to make sure that we add mental health because there's already curriculum developed for that. We passed Breeze Law a while ago for the dating violence program. We just
in those
making sure that there's guidelines, and if the department is developing those guidelines and instruction in mental health, that we'll also just have parental notification for those type of topics as well.
That's a follow up.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
So the Breeze Law curriculum that already has a parental notification component?
Because it's dealing with domestic violence, sexual assault, yes. That would be.
I'm sorry.
It would already be in the amendment already. I'm sorry, in that language that's already in the bill. Yes, brief Eddies. We're back on the record. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there is a way to narrow this amendment just a little bit. So it's something like, or mental health courses, or, you know, so it's specific to the instructional units that are going to be, that are going to come out of this process, if that makes sense. That is, if there is a class that has to do with mental health, that has notice. What I don't want to happen is a teacher, you know, happens to stray into mental health matters in a course about literature or something like that. You know, let's say they're talking about a poet who famously died by suicide, and they start talking about mental health, and then they are disciplined because they didn't anticipate it and didn't provide parental notification. So, is there a way that we can, you know, kind of narrow it to just the mental health courses as they're planned, like, or planned mental health courses, coursework or instructional unit? Perhaps the DEED folks could give me the right nomenclature to use.
Just reading through here. Now, the intent would be, especially dealing with something with suicide, that you would like to know as a parent if you had a relative that committed suicide and that topic wasn't going to be brought up in class, that you as a parent or guardian would be notified just in case you can be prepared to deal with any consequence or fallout or other emotional or well-being of that child and be ready to prep that child if they need those additional supports later on. You know, it does say before any activity, class, or program that includes that content of human reproduction, but we can ask Ms. Sharon Fischel if Senator Dunbar's scenario happened with, let's say, a sex education topic, how much leeway does the department have or educators have in terms of allowing that to occur? If they read a book where somebody, you know, there was a dating violence situation in there, and the kids have a discussion of that in the classroom, does parent notification need to go out before that? Or is that instruction activity or a classroom program that involves that?
Senator Wilson, this is Sharon Fischel from the Department of Education and Early Development. I'm not the person that can answer questions about the Safe Children's Act. I am here to represent the mental health, and I want to kind of remind the committee that Senator Gray Jackson's bill is about developing guidelines for teachers, so it's more of a standards development. It's not a curriculum development, but I do understand Senator Dunbar's concern about things happening organically in classrooms. And so, you know, teachers need to have some leeway to be able to have conversations with students that happen organically in the classroom when they're talking about suicide or other depression, anxiety, other mental health issues. And I hope that answers his question.
Oh, not really. Senator Geisel.
Well, actually, it did answer the question. And she used the example of suicide. But I'm thinking about the everyday classroom situation. A student is part of a class, and their best friend was the victim of domestic violence along with their mother. And that child is distraught and brings that into a classroom and talks with other students. And the teacher actually, in dealing with the situation, a group of students distraught about this kind of situation, that teacher is going to have to step in, or a counselor is going to have to step in and help those kids process. And that's mental health. This item number three here puts mental health with some odd subjects, requiring 2-week notice. You can't have notice for human situations that occur to everyday people. That's what students are, everyday people in our community. And so this really ties a teacher's hands. I think it would also tie any of the school faculty's hands. It talks about teachers, school administrators. It's very vague subject. It may not be part of the curriculum. It may simply come up in the course of a day in the life in a school. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can take this back and rework this amendment to try to refine it and talk about mental health curriculum, if that would be a better item. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you. This is Senator Gray Jackson, and I'm here with my staff, Bessie Odom. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I have a suggestion. Is it okay if I make that suggestion?
Of course.
I think if we just remove the word activity, that would address the matter. That's my thought process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That changes the other items. And like I said, we could rewrite a new amendment saying that parent notification and just leave that alone and just add another one for mental health curriculum. Senator Kaufman.
Just to the chair, I would just say I think this merits taking some effort to work it and be sure it's right.
Correct. Yes. So I will withdraw Amendment A1 at this point in time, and we will work with the bill sponsor again and try to get this better done. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're here at this hearing, can I talk about the fiscal note?
Yes.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the committee members. But during the last hearing, there were some concerns about the fiscal note, and the concerns were because last year's fiscal note was $71,000, and this year's fiscal note is $256,000. And I was tasked, if you will, with talking to the department and seeing what we can come up with in terms of revising the fiscal note. And I had an initial meeting with staff. And after the initial meeting, staff agreed, and they were going to develop a different fiscal note that was not $256,000. And that was several weeks ago. But last week, I met again with staff, and they had a reason for why the fiscal note, well, it was their reason for why the fiscal note went from $71,000 to $256,000. And one of the reasons was because there were 20 committee members last time, and 30 committee members this time. But during our conversations, my question was, well, why 30 now? when there were 20 last year. So if I may, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, can we hear from the department their reasoning for the fiscal note being $256,000 as opposed to $71,000? They're online, and they know that I was going to bring this subject matter up.
Normally, we would defer to the next committee of referral, the Finance Committee, but yeah, sure, they're online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Manning, did you want to answer or respond to Senator Gray Jackson's question?
Yeah, good afternoon. Again, for the record, this is Kelly Manning, Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence for the Department of Education. And so first, I want to note that the department did meet with Senator Gray Jackson and took under consideration the requests for how we could review and address the fiscal note. And we went back to our team and we really dug in on the fiscal note that we had presented and, you know, came to the conclusion that that fiscal note is reflective of the current costs for the work. And there's a couple of considerations that went into that. And so I'll start with Senator Gray Jackson's comment about the committee of 30. And part of the reason that we had made a recommendation for a committee of 30, or that we put that into the fiscal note, is that especially when we're looking at mental health and the content of this particular bill, we have two separate groups that we want to engage. So we have partners that work in the field of mental health around the state, partners that we would engage in this that reflect the subject matter experts, and we also have district representatives from around the state. And our efforts when we're doing standards updates work is always to have representation from a number of districts that reflect different size and geographic location. And so when we looked at what that group would look like and went through and kind of counted out who would those ideal partners be, we really found that 30 is the appropriate number for the type of work that we're considering here. In addition, I would note that the work that we would be doing with this standards update requires a facilitator for a number of reasons. One is that the work itself requires someone that can come in and have that that national expertise, understand the national landscape for the type of work that we're looking at, as well as the Alaska landscape, facilitate that work in a way that allows for neutrality, and also has the skill and expertise in being able to facilitate, you know, challenging conversations in groups that may have differing perspectives so that we can get to an effective standard that is reflective of the scope of need for the state. The cost for that, what we've found with recent work that we've been doing with similar standards type work, has gone up significantly since COVID. And so that's one of the reasons that our fiscal note is a bit higher than it was in a previous fiscal note. And that's based off of actuals from work that we've done in the past year that has demonstrated that those costs have gone up. In addition, I would note that in the past we have had the ability to attract educators with lower stipends. And what we have found in recent years is that with the challenges that our staff are facing, which we've talked quite a bit about this legislative session around staffing shortages and increased pressures on districts post-COVID, challenges because of the short staffing of being able to release staff to participate in this type of work, being able to provide a substantial stipend that recognizes the extra duty work of educators is an important component that we can't really strip back, or we are struggle to get that engagement. And that educator engagement is really important for ensuring that we have effective implementation of standards, both the standards development work and then also the work of implementing after those standards have been developed. So those are some of the factors that we looked into and evaluated as we met and discussed the fiscal note. And we believe that that's reflective of what it would take to do this work in the current, you know, with current costs and requirements.
Thank you. Any questions on Ms. Manning's answer? I would just comment, Senator Gray Jackson, this is not a uncommon scenario that we've seen this year. I think even the Senate President Stevens had a bill that exponentially grew in cost from last year to this year. I've had notes that had a zero note last year that somehow picked up a $400,000 note this year. And I can tell you that the Senate Finance Committee has been taking a hard look at some of these notes and making sure that the costs are matching. So when and if this bill gets up there, we will I'm sure that they will also take a hard look at the note as we continue having these conversations. So you have my assurance on that. Any further comments before we set this bill aside and hopefully can bring it up at our next committee meeting? Seeing none, we will take a brief at ease so we can get to our next item of business. We are back on the record, and we have our last item of business, Senate Bill 91, by Senator Klayman's office. This is the telehealth multidisciplinary care team. We have a senator here at the podium with his staff, Emma Potter, and we first heard this bill and took public and invited in public testimony on March 21st. And before we get to the amendment process, are there any questions from the bill sponsor? Anything the bill sponsor would like to start? Seeing none, we have two amendments that were given to the committee. And I'm going to turn to my amendments. First, I would like to move Amendment A6, which is sponsored by my office, Senator Wilson.
I object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. Amendment A6 changes the fee for the telehealth registry, which is maintained by the Department of Commerce. And we heard testimony that it was just a one-time fee and no update, so it was just basically this blanketed item. This amendment changes that registration fee just to go along with the times of inflation to about $100, which can be renewed now every 3 years. And this does not change the existing fee of $50 to change the business registration information that was already in statute. Any questions on that amendment? Senator Tobin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, in Section 5 of the amendment, you come up with an initiation fee of 100, a renewal fee of 100, and then a fee to report changes to the business registration information of 50. And I'm curious why stipulation number 3 exists within this amendment, as my understanding, and maybe I just need some clarification, is that the hope is that we receive accurate information that includes name, address, and contact information from businesses performing teleservices, and the $50 just to update your information may be prohibitive to getting accurate information when they do change or have changes in their business. So I'm just curious to understand a little bit more there.
And thank you, Senator Tobin. Again, we did not change that. That was already an existing statute and law. That was already an existing, and we can have Ms. Sullivan Robb, if she wants to speak to that line of.
For the record, Sullivan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Senator Tobin, the chair is correct. The current fee to register with the telemedicine registry is $50.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm curious what the statute is. I just wanted to look, as I see that this statute is amending by adding a new section, and so I think I'm just looking in the wrong spot, so I don't have the right information in front of me.
We'll take a brief at ease. Senator Tobin.
Thank you very much. I do see here that we have under Section 44.33.381, telemedicine business registry, and it indicates that the department shall adopt regulations for establishing and maintaining the registry of businesses. And I do not see anywhere listed that there are fees within the statute. So I would indicate that my reservation is in establishing a fee system within statute, as often it needs to be updated or amended, and it's difficult to amend statutes, much easier to do it in regulation. And so that's, I think that's where some of my reservation is coming from. In addition to here, there is a reference around Section C, subsection 2, telemedicine services and delivery of healthcare services using and transferring medical data through all these different systems. And it indicates a period of time. It does not indicate a period of time. So I think additionally, I might have some reservation around the 3 years of registration as many businesses update their information every 2 years. And so I'm interested if you would be willing to have a conceptual amendment or amendment to your amendment here to help update some information, potentially changing line 7 of page 1 to say every 2 years, and then striking 7.5 and allowing those fees to be set in regulation.
If we could break those up into two separate items, my hesitation here is that the department has not updated these items of registration fees, and without a legislative push or nudge, I'm afraid that it will just still stay stagnant, as there's lots of fees and other items that we've just not addressed.
I am more than happy to separate those into two motions.
Okay, thank you. Senator Tobin.
So my first conceptual amendment would be to change line 7 and line 9 of page 1 of amendment number A.6 to state the department may renew every 2 years the registration of a business that meets all renewal requirements established by regulation and pay a renewal fee every 2 years.
All right. Is there objection? Seeing none, that amendment to Amendment A6 passes. And let's take a brief at ease here. Back on the record, Senator Tobin.
So I would move conceptual amendment number 2, which is still on A.6, section 5, amending line 13 of page 1 to state initial registration fee of 100 with a, not semicolon, a, whatever this is to correct, punctuation would be to be adjusted for inflation. Set by the department.
Thank you. Senator, we will object for conversation. Senator Kaufman.
How will that, my question is, how will that be administered? So will every year someone pay a slightly different amount? So what's the basis for that? How is that set?
And that would go through the regulatory process. This is my understanding. We can have Director Rob speak to the regulatory process on how the department operates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair to Senator Kaufman. We do have most of our fees are contained within regulations so that they are easier to update. The majority of fees that the division charges are adjusted periodically because all of the professional licensing is fee-supported services, and so we're statutorily required that the amount we're charging for fees is roughly equal to the cost to administer those programs. The telemedicine business registry is a little bit of an unusual situation that doesn't have a great administrative burden in terms of administering it. So we would look at the fees periodically. We normally check fees and update, do the fee analysis every 2 years. Just it's easier as we get to renewal to change the fees as licensees come into their renewal period. And so with the amendment. If this would be every 2 years, then we would probably look at that fee every 2 years.
Senator Kaufman?
Thank you. Through the chair, mostly just a comment. I just want to be sure that we're not driving in incremental change that costs more than it recoups in the administration of it. So
Thank you. Senator Easel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would offer an amendment to the amendment to the amendment and apply the adjusted by inflation for number two, which is line 14, and that being the renewal fee as well.
Seeing no objection, that two also passes. Sorry, and I will remove my objection for the main one, but I'll maintain my objections. So on the amendment process from Senator Tobin.
No, this is a separate.
Okay. So let me go ahead and remove my objection to Senator Tobin. And seeing no further objection, her conceptual amendment as amended by Senator Giesel has passed. And now we are back to the amendment A6 before us as amended, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand subsection D1 and 2, the initial registration renewal fees, and I'm hoping we actually just increase those fees by 50% by changing from 3 years to 2 years as well. I'm hoping that that will be enough for the department to recoup its costs. I'm sort of curious about subsection 3 and wondering if we might want to strike it out. And the reason is because that is a behavior that we want to encourage, as we want people to report their businesses even when there's a change in registration. Some of these businesses might be a little bit difficult to enforce. If I was a business and I changed offices, for example, I might wait until my next annual renewal before I reported that change. So if I had to pay extra money in order to report it. So I was wondering if maybe Ms. Robb could speak to that, or you, Mr. Chair, if we could talk about whether or not subsection 3 might be a little bit counterproductive.
And as this was a initial item that's already in the regs, I will let Ms. Sullivan Robb talk to that, because I don't want to just willy-nilly start changing their regs without hearing from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Senator Dunbar. This is currently in the regulation, and so the conceptual change that you're proposing, it's hard to say what the change in behavior would be, because we're existing under where right now there is a fee to make that change.
Senator Dunbar.
Were you before for the renewal fees? How often were you charging those renewal fees, $100?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the telemedicine business registry had a perpetual, so it never expired. So there was no renewal fee.
Okay, so we have now changed regulation in that fashion. So now we've added a renewal fee. Is that right? Or are we about to, perhaps?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, assuming the will of the committee is positive, then yes, you would be about to make that change.
So unlike previous iterations where it was perpetual and you had to have some mechanism for them to report their changes, now we have a two-year renewal where we're going to know every 2 years they're going to register in some new place. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, in order to do that renewal, they would need to submit documents and a fee to the division, and so we would be aware of any changes that they might want to submit at that time.
Yes, a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you think that that renewal process might be sufficient in order to sort of collect the data you need, or do you think this additional $50 charge is also needed?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it feels like a little bit of a policy call. There's not a lot of work that's done with the data that exists on the telemedicine registry at this time. If there was interest in investigating that more, then there would be greater benefit in having it be more up to date. But at this time, it is really just a registration and a list of telemedicine providers within the state. Excuse me, telemedicine providers providing services in Alaska. You do not need to be located in Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Robb. So, Mr. Chair, I think I would maintain and suggest to the committee that we amend out subsection 3, given that the prior system was perpetual. Now we have created a renewal system that will hopefully collect a lot of the data that we're seeking.
Any comments or discussion? There's not a motion yet. Just
I haven't made a motion yet.
Having conversation. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, first of all, I would call your attention to the fiscal note this bill has. It does cost something. And secondly, the Division of Professional Licensing does prompt licensees that renewals are coming due, which requires correct contact information. And so these kinds of businesses, healthcare businesses, do sometimes change their email address, change their name, they're bought out. So making sure that those changes have been recorded somewhere is helpful, mainly to the licensees, but also to the division. That would be my advocacy for leaving the $50. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. And I will say most healthcare industries are quite, this should be just be a blip on their financials. Any further conversation? Senator Dunbar.
This is just me learning about the amendment process. Is it typical that we hear from the sponsor of the bill as well about the amendment before we?
You can always ask that question of the bill sponsor.
Could I ask the bill sponsor how he feels about subsection 3 of subsection D?
Yes. Senator Klayman.
Thank you to the chair and to Senator Dunbar, particularly in light of the proposal to require re-registering every 2 years and increasing the minimum fee, which would be adjusted for inflation. I just tend to see the $50 fee as a disincentive to provide the information on behalf of the businesses. I've just seen that as somebody that works in the House for businesses that are supposed to provide that registration. Usually the thing that gets us to provide the updated information is the 2 year later registration requirement. And it's not that often that you remember to send notice to the state anyway about an address change. And so if there was also $50 you were paying for the address change, I'd be even less inclined to provide it. And so I think it's the other place that I'm a little troubled is that these are regulations the department currently has, and they certainly have flexibility to put regulations like this in. I have some hesitancy to start getting too quick to legislate things that at least currently are mostly done by regulation. So for those two reasons, I would be supportive of an amendment to take out line 15 and 16 from the amendment.
Can I ask a brief follow-up?
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
So Senator Klayman just raised something I hadn't considered. Let's say we remove subsection 3. The department still wouldn't be barred to impose a fee like that through regulation, correct? They would not be prevented from doing so.
Correct.
Okay. So I guess I will make a motion, an amendment to the amendment to strike subsection D3.
All right. And I will object for that. I just want to make sure that we can keep businesses registration information there. It's cost money, these entities, and their purpose is just to make sure really to track in-state and out-of-state, as a former senator just always wanted to make sure that that was there, and successors here now, and so we just want to make sure that we want to continue to honor that sort of that idea of having the in-state, out-of-state. I don't want folks to start registering in-state and then changing to an out-of-state item. And I understand that that might be in the renewal fee, but I just feel that they should be able to report and pay a fee for the department to process that change. I'm sure it's going to could take 15 minutes, could take an hour. I'm not sure how long the department will take. And I honestly, I've seen regs take 6 years to complete, and I just don't have faith in the regulatory process of the administrative function. It doesn't matter if it's this administration, past administrations, it's always taken a snail's pace to move regulations through the regulatory process. I mean, the fastest is probably 6 months, and that's an act of God to get that done. And so that's just my hesitancy on allowing that to work through the regulatory process. So there's no offense to anyone that works on regs in the department. It's just it takes a very long time, as it should, to write regs, but sometimes it's just won't finish that statement. I apologize. Senator Geisel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with your thoughts. The cost of state government is increasing. I know that the Division of Professional Licensing actually is shorthanded. I cite some examples, but I won't at this point. And so that $50 fee could really make a difference in funding the activities related to this bill. So I support your support for this amendment, lines 15 and 16.
Thank you. Any other further comments before we take roll? Seeing none, we will go ahead and...
So is the motion made, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, the motion was made.
To strike out that subsection.
Yes, and I have objected.
Thank you.
Senator Wiesel?
No.
Senator Dunbar?
Yes.
Senator Tobin?
Yes.
Senator Claflin?
No.
Senator Wilson?
No.
Two yeas, three nays.
With a vote of three nays and two yeas, that amendment fails, which brings us back to Amendment A6 as amended. Any further conversation? Is the objection maintained?
I remove my objection.
Is there a further objection? Seeing none, Amendment A6 has passed, which brings us to Amendment A8 by Senator Giesel. Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment A8.
All right. I will object for conversation. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the goal of this amendment is the goal I have for any licensees in the state or services offered in the state, and that being that Alaskans are providing those services in as many opportunities as possible. So the amendment would, first of all, lines 1 through 4 of page 1, indicates that members of this of the multidisciplinary team could offer healthcare through telehealth, but only if that healthcare service is not otherwise available in the state. So that would take us in logical discussion down to lines 12 through, hold steady, page 2, line 4. And in this section of the amendment, I identify in section 3, which starts on line 12, the members of the multidisciplinary care team, and I identify the professions that are logical in providing telehealth. The original bill provided telehealth being offered by a chiropractor, dental hygienist, dentist, direct entry midwife, dispensing optician, and physical therapist for occupational therapist. I removed those because it's illogical for a dental hygienist to practice telehealth. A direct entry midwife, dispensing optician, etc. So these remaining members are people, professions that could provide services through telehealth. And then in section 4, that it just defines that they need to be registered, that they're providing services in the state, and proof of licensure in some state or territory of the U.S. with applicable fees. Mm-hmm. And then page 3, lines 3 through 5, deletes the section that says includes a physician licensed in another state who meets the requirements of B1. Because we already have telehealth provided for physicians. So it seemed illogical to repeat it again. So that is the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry. Any committee conversation? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
I'm sorry, Senator Giesel. So I caught it was PTOT, direct entry midwife, dental hygienist. Is there a... The people who are not in this list.
Correct. If you start at the beginning of the original bill, page 2, line 20, start there and kind of go through them alphabetically. Chiropractor was removed. Dental hygienist. Dentist. and then going down to direct entry midwife, dispensing optician. These are the guys that give you glasses. And physical therapist or occupational therapist.
So all of those, may I, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
All of those make sense to me, except perhaps physical therapist or occupational therapist. Just thinking about, for better or worse, I have received a lot of physical therapy in my life through injuries sustained in the Army and sports. And sometimes I don't actually, or I'll go into the office, but basically they just give me, here are some pictures of what you should be doing. You know, this is what you do with this rubber ball or something like that. And so I'm wondering if that perhaps could be done remotely in a way that I mean, a dental hygienist midwife, that makes a lot of sense. But physical therapy and maybe occupational therapy as well, do you see any circumstances where you perhaps could provide some services through telehealth?
Senator Geisler.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. You make a good point. However, a physical therapist also has to assess your progress, and that generally can't be done without that therapist being present to test muscle strength, range of motion, those kinds of things. The same applies to an occupational therapist, strength of grip. That's certainly challenging to do without actually touching and seeing the patient. Thank you.
And before we go to Senator Kaufman, just on Senator Geisel, this is only addressing those multidisciplinary team in terms of seeing out of state. So if an in-state physical therapist can still meet with somebody. I just want to clarify that.
Correct. And okay. That's articulated in the amendment lines 2 through 4. The service is not otherwise available in the state.
Correct.
So, yes.
All right. Yes. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, just to the committee and the amendment sponsor, I just did a quick look. I had heard of the actual ability for smartphones to measure one's eyes, that there's apparently some type of budding technology for telehealth optometry. And just a quick search of the web, I found statute in Texas and other states that's addressing telehealth optometry. So I'm not sure we may be behind the technological curve on that one.
And Senator Geisel.
Thank you. An optician is not an optometrist. Optometry examines your eyes, checks pressure of the inner eye, checking for glaucoma, things like that. A dispensing optician fits you for glasses, makes sure the lens and your visual field is going through the proper part of the lens, makes sure that the glasses fit, etc. Ophthalmologist is an eye surgeon that actually removes the cornea and replaces it, that the optician has observed you need.
Or removes foreign objects from eyes. Senator Kaufman.
Thanks. Through the chair to the amendment sponsor. I guess so. What about these places that you can send a prescription to and they mail you glasses? How would that work?
And I'll take that. So the idea here is that we want to allow for out-of-state folks to – this is very limited for a multidisciplinary physician team for life-threatening conditions. Getting fitted and mailing glasses is not a – I don't consider that as a life-threatening condition. So I just want to bring this back to the purpose of this
first – You want to see me without my
glasses. Senator Dunbar, then Senator Tobin.
I was going to ask the bill sponsor again, if I could, about this amendment. And, you know, this bill came about for a sort of very specific reason. There are people with ALS who have these out-of-state multidisciplinary teams that I don't fully understand. I mean, I don't understand everything that's involved in that process. And so I'm wondering, the list of excluded professions in the amendment, would any of those have impacted the, like, midwife, I assume, would not have impacted. Dental hygienist, I don't think, impacts ALS. But are there any in there that would have impacted the multidisciplinary teams of the ALS patients that sort of prompted this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I think I probably should address your question probably in three different levels and three different areas. First, with regard to the members of a multidisciplinary care team, this bill came to us through Sheila Swanson, who's a constituent who has ALS, and I actually spoke with her earlier today to ask her specifically about who's on the multidisciplinary care team. She has both a physical therapist and an occupational therapist on her multidisciplinary care team. Much of this bill is about whether insurance covers it or not. She has an occupational therapist in Seattle that she specifically discussed a conversation with her about how she was losing function in one of her hands, and that's a symptom of the ALS, and that occupational therapist then made suggestions about modifications they should make to the house to help address her diminishing function. So she was actually able to provide specific instances in which the telehealth, which I guess with the insurance, if she wants to get telehealth from those providers, she has to pay cash for that and doesn't get coverage, but she can of course still get the care. But she was specifically identifying physical therapy and occupational therapy as specialties that she does use telehealth for, and sometimes she sees them, but other times she can consult on the phone, and with Zoom and stuff, you can actually see how she's functioning. We also communicated both with the ALS group here in Alaska, the nonprofit, as well as the American Cancer Society, and they raised questions in the first section of the amendment regarding otherwise that the care is not otherwise available in the state. And the concern they both raised was that it opens up a question of who has the burden of showing it's not otherwise available, and whether that's a function of whether it's the patient's duty to try to show it's not otherwise available, or whether that becomes the insurance company's duty to say it is available, so we're not going to provide coverage for you. And so that was an area that both those organizations found very confusing. Senator Kaufman raised the question about an optometrist and teleoptometry with an iPhone app, and an optometrist is one of the specialties that is actually taken out in the amendment and can't provide telehealth. But I thought about that somewhat more expansively. Brain cancer is one of the areas in which you actually start having significant brain function changing, and I could see if somebody that has been providing some eye care in person and then has a follow-up because they're having vision issues, that they would probably want to be able to talk to the person that saw them last and not have to start anew with somebody else. And so I worry when we start making lists that they're both over-inclusive and under-inclusive in an unintentional way. So I have hesitancy about Section 3 of the amendment, and my general perspective on that is that our starting point with this is that there's a multidisciplinary care team. It doesn't mean that any optometrist could come in and say, now I'm going to provide care for somebody because I'm in a multidisciplinary care team. They actually have to have a life-threatening condition. They have to have a primary physician, and I think the provisions in the amendment, which is Section 4, that actually requires the member of the multidisciplinary care team to specifically identify who the physician is, a very desired, on behalf of the amendment sponsor, has the effect of limiting the group of people who are even seeking the care, because it means you're not at risk that a bunch of people start saying, well, I'm providing multidisciplinary care to all these people, because they actually have to identify who the physician sponsor or the physician referral is in what is Section 4 of the amendment. And I think by having Section 4 of the amendment, you essentially make it so that only the very, very narrow group of folks that are actually part of the team and are coordinating with the physician are providing the telehealth. And so what is the odds that the physician is referring a chiropractor to the team? Pretty low. But if the chiropractor isn't added, we don't really need to worry about that being excluded, because the practical reality is they're seldom going to get asked. And I think the same goes with the midwives and others, that even though I think it's very unlikely that that comes into play, I don't think we really need to be getting to that level of detail in what we passed as a statute, because the requirement in Section 4 that says who as the physician has to be on the team and identifies on this team, you're effectively going to take out most of the other folks. I mean, I could imagine places in which a dentist that did some kind of mouthpiece that helps somebody sleep, they're having problems with it, they call up the dentist in another state and say, I don't know what's going on, what should I do? And that sort of follow-up should be included. And again, I think it's going to be very, very rare that ever shows up as a multidisciplinary care team. So I guess if the concern is, it's just striking, how do you balance between providing care for the patient that wants the care with the interest in trying to maximize Alaska providers wherever possible? And I think that the best way to do that is primarily through Section 4 of the amendment, I'm troubled with the first part about it, about otherwise available, and I'm also troubled with Section 3. And that's a pretty long answer to a short question.
I just want to give a time check. We're almost at time, so Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I appreciate Senator Klayman pointing out that I had forgotten to say optometrist was also removed from the list that appears in the amendment. I neglected to mention that one. Thank you.
All right, Senator, do you have a follow-up, Senator Dunbar?
Senator Tobin.
Senator Tobin.
All right. Can I ask a follow-up then?
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Mr. Chair, is there any way that we could amend Section 1 of the amendment in such a way that it wouldn't shift the burden or make it easier for the patients to get coverage from – I'm sorry, this is to you, Senator Klayman, since you raised the concern with Senator Geisel's amendment, Section 1, is there any way that we could alleviate that by changing that language? Or is it like an irreducible problem?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, my initial read on it would be to change on line 4, change not otherwise available to read not reasonably available in the state. But I also would be a little hesitant to go too far down that line without getting some feedback on that suggestion from the ALS group here in Alaska, as well as the Cancer Society, because they're the folks that are actually dealing with patients that are often leaving the state for very, very specialized care and working with these specialized care teams. And so my short answer is change otherwise to reasonably, but I'm also a little bit reserved in going down that too fast.
Right. So we can take a brief at ease. We are back on the record. We are at committee in and time. I just want to thank everyone for continuing to work through Senate Bill 91. We'll bring this back up to finish our committee work on this process. And with that, we are adjourned at 5 o'clock. And our next committee is bills previously scheduled and heard. And we will come out with a committee list here shortly on what's on the agenda, depending on what we get back from Lance Legal. With that, we are adjourned.